Wouldn't it be great if three idiots picked apart each episode of your favorite podcast?
We do that. Wouldn't it be great if we discussed the newest episode, ongoing theories, and predictions for what comes next?
We do that. Wouldn't it be great if they didn't ruin the podcast at all and kept everything spoiler-free?
We don't do that. You've been warned.
Welcome to We Do That, a Taz Fancast. I'm your co-host, Chris.
And I'm Jake, immune to metaphors, Stringer.
And I'm your other co-host, Colin.
This week's episode, Dust, Episode 2.
Alright guys, here's a synopsis for you. This week on Taz Dust, the gang continues their investigation. Gandy Dancer and Gust...
Excuse me. That is Augustus.
Oh, well, my apologies. They cheat at ghost poker, visit an indungeoned Marcus, and Gandy consents to having her blood drawn. Errol visits Anne and Liam, learns of a secret betrothal, finds a murder weapon.
Alleged.
And is whisked away to visit the Banshee.
It's a big episode, y'all. Not just for the McElroys, but also for us.
Yeah. We crossed 500 downloads. How crazy is that, guys?
It's wild. I don't think I even know 500 people in my whole life. So it's kind of amazing. Internet friends are the best friends.
Yeah. No, and so we just really appreciate, you know, that these probably aren't huge numbers for real podcasts, but the idea that there are a lot of you out there who want to spend your time listening to us just... talk out of our asses for an hour a week is really humbling, and we appreciate it.
Thank you all so much.
Also, did y'all know that the song That Was a Crazy Game of Poker is about a poker game with the devil, and not just a really boring 8.5 minute song about cards?
Is that the OAR song that they're referencing, or is it
yes.
a different one?
Okay. No, that's the song.
I had to go and Google it later when they were doing it, because it didn't land for me.
That also didn't land yeah. for me. But I did not know it was a song about poker with the devil.
Hashtag missed metaphors. See, that loops back into my funny little bit at the beginning.
Is that a metaphor?
Oh, yeah, it's very, very good. I see what you did there. That's nice. That's nice. That's nice.
Somehow, I don't think you feel that way. Before you razz me anymore, I cast Zone of Truth.
All right. I'll step up. I did pretty well. Griffin did successfully complete his mission to get at least himself to Carrion Street, though it had seemingly no bearing on what he did there. So cool. But I was wrong on the other half where Travis let him do it. Though, in fairness, I do think Griffin just kind of bullied his way onto Carrion Street and invented a community garden that he somehow runs in the desert. We'll get to that.
Yeah,
and Travis is like, fine, just go fair, go. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Just yeah, let's end this. I predicted that they would visit the Fang Bar, which did happen, and predicted that the arc will end up hinging on Sheriff Connors, which may or may not be the case yet. We don't yet know.
TBD.
But the sheriff might be the Banshee, so I'm just gonna go ahead and chalk that up as a win.
Yeah, I'll count it. And I predicted that Marcus wanted to start a business war between the Fangs and the Furs, which has a grain of truth because we suddenly realized in the beginning of the episode that there is business dealing going on, and it might be getting interrupted. And I don't think Marcus is as down and out as he might seem. So I won't call it a win, but there is definitely a kernel of truth to it.
So we did pretty well, y'all. That was pretty good predictions on our part.
Yeah, we're getting good at this.
Yeah, it's a little scary.
Yeah.
McElroy should watch out.
All right. Well, let's figure out what we got wrong about the week. Because, well, not what we got wrong about the week. I did some bad listening. I have a complaint about the beginning of this episode, just from the jump. I am very used to them. Here's a problem that I have that I'd like to blame on somebody else. I'm very used to them sort of ramping their way slowly into the episode and then getting to story. And in this one, they finally like pulled off a in media res start, and it kind of threw me for a loop. I had to go back and listen to the beginning of the episode 3 or 4 times before I figured out what was happening. I think that's great. I think that's good storytelling, but it did throw me off for a while.
And I think the... So we're talking about this like whole business dealing reveal. And I'm with you. I think it was super cool. But I think it needed a little more on both sides to like make sense. Like, we had no context that it might be coming. And then the actual discussion of it was over super briefly. So in my bad listening the first time, I completely missed like those two sentences. And then spent the whole rest of the episode really confused about what business deal was happening and was getting broken up. Really confused.
Yeah, I did not miss it because I am a good listener. but I was a little confused as to the logic behind it. I mean, I can certainly somewhat understand the idea of incorporation might be helpful. But I wouldn't think that would just immediately lead to new business and sustainable business that would allow them to, you know, somehow revamp the area.
Well, and I do think there's a little bit of confusion, too, about sort of the world that Travis has put us in, because I don't fully understand the relationship between Dry River and the Crescent Territory yet. I know he's spoken about it, but this is becoming a very high-level political discussion, and so not knowing how those tensions exist, what the structures are, makes it hard to see the gravity of what they're outlining as the main plot of this coming together of the two companies and the miners. Like, I don't know what tensions currently exist. I don't know what other cities there are. And I know when Travis talked about in the setup episode, he talked about talking about balancing the game. We're making the territory be like a city, so there's other cities to go to. But we haven't really heard anything about that, and maybe they're getting there. I'm afraid to immediately start calling out our typical mini arc overreach kind of spiel that we go on, but it does seem like they're just kind of hanging out at the bars in their homes, and we're already through episode 2. If they're going to start going venturing to other towns and visiting other places, getting that world flavor is going to be hard to pull off in 5 episodes. And I don't know, and it feels like we need some of that world flavor to understand the gravity of the deal they're trying to make.
Yeah.
So I worry that it's going to get sort of lost as we go through that. Obviously this is the tipping point, but I don't understand the tension that's there.
Yeah. And
it makes me wonder how satisfying a resolution we can get in 8 hours.
Well, and that's,
you know,
that's
again,
a good point.
If that is the timeline, you know, we are bound by this clock that Travis has set for us. And I think that works for a smaller scale story, but roping in some of these big things really can complicate that.
Yeah. Well, and it leads to some more obvious issues. Like, you know, I've been pretty willing to part with travel time as an issue when they're staying in town, you know, moving from the church to the saloon, to the Sterling, to what have you. But if they start going, okay, and now we travel, you know, up to the next town, like, well, that probably took you an hour, so that's the 3 to 4 hours just gone. Like, we're still in the Old West, We still have a stagecoach or whatever. Like, you're riding horses. There's no car or train or plane to bounce you around.
What do you think the airspeed velocity of an unladen ghost is?
Is he unladen?
I mean, what did he choose? So he's...
That was a Monty Python joke, guys. Don't analyze it so much.
Hey, man, if you're bringing it to the table, we're going in on it. Welcome to this podcast.
Yeah.
So if he's chosen to be unladen, that means he cannot be touched, and he probably can't touch, so he's just visible. But that means he shouldn't have any wind resistance, so fast.
Well, now...
Hey, how do ghosts move? Because if he can't touch things, then he's not pushing against the ground. So, is he walking? Does he float? Oof.
Yeah, what about gravity?
It was a good movie.
It was a good movie. I very much liked that movie. I'm pretty sure you can't say he's unladen because his spirit is laden with debts.
Oh, great point. Great point.
Okay, so how much does a debt weigh?
About $1.50.
It depends on to whom the debt is owed and how much you, carry it with
care.
You. Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying, I don't think he could be unladen. I think he would move pretty slowly between towns.
Well, I think the better question is not what is, like, physically possible, but what feels right for Augustus. And I don't think Augustus goes anywhere particularly quickly. He seems a very measured man, and in his corporeal form, would probably not have rushed off to anything. And now, in his more phantasmagorical state, he might embrace the same leisurely pacing and more thoughtful methods of moving about the world.
That's fair.
Yeah, I would expect the same.
So, walking speed.
30 feet? Like, 30 feet per turn? Like, let's put some D&D rules on this.
Slightly slower than walking speed.
Because, is he levitating?
No.
Because, like, that's a different move speed.
Well, no, I think he's walking. I think he takes walking actions. I wonder whether his feet hit anything.
I wonder whether his ghost form has legs or if it just, trails off into a Casper tail.
Another great question.
My hope is Casper tail.
It just sort of disappears from the waist down.
Yeah, and just fades. Yeah.
All right.
Well, our listeners enjoy that discussion.
Yeah, Gus doesn't have to go very far in this episode because they start off in the saloon talking to the Mathis matriarch, and then they catch up with the owner of the goods store, who starts with an A and isn't Ann. So is... Nope. Lost it. Anybody got it?
So in the werewolf bar, I don't remember who they talked to. but what I took away from it was that Travis will not let Justin do his funny human interactions of, hey, other woman at the bar... No, you know her name. It's like, well, come on. It's no fun.
Right. It's, I think we could either chalk that up to Travis, no jokes on my arc, McElroy, or another one of those failures of how do they know what they're supposed to know if they don't know it kind of deals.
Yeah.
Well, and so I appreciated Juice's being able to use his faction move, right?
But,
that seemed like a really good in-fiction way to be like, okay, here's information you don't have, but here's how you can get it. And that seemed like a creepo.
Yeah, I really don't know how, and like, if it wasn't part of their intel that they had initially, I don't know, it seems like you're robbing, I don't know, maybe you're getting to the point of more character interaction, because you don't have to go through all the, discussion back and forth, but I think you're missing the fun part of how they interact with NPCs, which, as I've said before, I think is one of the funniest parts of the Adventure Zone because they are so bad at talking to NPCs and introducing themselves that I think
right. It's
we're deprived of.
They have repeatedly said that they're bad at small talk in person, so doing it.
Yeah.
with created characters, they're equally bad at it, and it does create great moments. I do think I kind of like it as a way to get past that and get into the meat of the story, especially when we're talking for mini arc systems, when we really want to sort of move things along as quick as possible. I think
the issue I have with it is that, you know, you're moving it from dialogue to just exposition of just Travis saying, this is what you know. Whereas if that same thing can be done through player interaction, I think you do it through player interaction. Or do it off camera.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just a question of what... I don't know that I need to see the player interaction happening if it moves the story along in an appropriate way. Since the arc's going to be so short, I don't imagine them forming any lasting relationships with NPCs like would have happened in the balance arc. So why not sort of just use them as the informational tools that they are and get on with moving through the story and having the player characters really drive what's going on rather than interactions between player characters and NPCs being a focus of the plot.
Well, I agree. I think I want the player interaction for the humor aspect of it. And if the point was to move the story along, why not say, you know, from your intel that this, why make him do a faction move? Cause they definitely later in this,
to level up.
Well, later in the story, they definitely have like, you know, from your intel, this person is this.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I think it's this inconsistency, that also robs us of Justin trying to talk to an NPC that I don't like. Yeah, exactly.
I am glad that this arc, they started addressing, like, how chill are people with ghosts in this world? Like, is everybody cool that there are ghosts around?
I feel like our rules with the Z compendium is sort of filling out a little bit.
Yeah, and they're, you know, and I imagine it's because the player characters are starting to see, like, I need to know, you know, can I do sweet root beer tricks? Or is that just going to be like, oh, there's a ghost over there. Who cares? Nothing matters. Yeah. And you can't use that to their advantage.
Yeah, it definitely seems. I mean, I think especially when Travis introduced a ghost card shark.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I guess ghosts are everywhere.
Or just at least hanging out wherever he needs to be.
Yeah, at the very least, they're not unusual.
It's not unusual to see a ghost playing cards. Da-da-da-da.
I just want it for the record that I did not do that one.
Hey, man, that was a good one.
It was good. No, like, you beat me to it by a hair. But I'm not the only one who enjoys random sing-alongs.
Everybody needs a good sing-along.
That was bad.
All right. So we wrap up in the tavern. And one of the things that I really appreciated that I think we addressed some last week was that Travis laid out all of the options for them. Like, here is the menu of places that you can select. Yeah. You know, and we talked about, well, what if they just never knew that they could have gone to a place and missed out on that information? And so I think framing it this way, like, here are all of your choices, makes the information that they do or do not gain more valuable, and it really, the consequences of their actions are a little more concrete, like, because they see what they didn't choose. And so I think that's a really good way to handle this.
Especially in
sort of this sort of more freeform, first more freeform experiment they're trying to do.
Well, and so I disagree a little bit. I think I would have played it, or wanted to see it played a little more like they played the 11th Hour arc in Refuge, where they just have a map, and, you know, here are the places you can go. Where do you want to go? And with the 8-hour time limit, it puts a lot more pressure on the character, saying, okay, you know, make sure it's a good place that we're going. Don't just go, you know, to the library, which will be closed, and this place probably doesn't have a library, but you know, it would really add, I think, more weight to the character decisions, as opposed to the GM saying, here's where you've been kind of directed to go.
I mean, I don't know that there's that much difference between the two of them, really. Because whether the GM provides the map or the GM provides the list, it's still not giving them infinite options. I suppose it's just a matter of, with the map, they know all of the options. Like,
the town
is finite, and you know everything that is there. Whereas if Travis just narrates it, we don't know what he's leaving out. Like, you could go to the mine, but he has not said that. You know, if we had a map, it would show the silver mine, the copper mine, the Sterling, the werewolf bar, you know, the residential area.
And that's exactly what I think. You know, it'll show places where they may not have been directed, but they may choose to go anyway. And that decision may be a very bad one because it wastes time and there's nothing there. But that's
a natural consequence that they could then take on, and that would be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess I've now come around to your point. Damn it.
Yes.
I hate when that happens.
I love it. All right, so the party splits back up. Gandhi and Augustus go to
you need more of a draw. It's Augustus.
I'm not doing that.
You were verging on Augustus, the German version.
Augustus.
Augustus.
They go to the Fang Bar while Errol goes to the Mathis house. So let's start with the Fang Bar. What'd you guys think of Sterling's? Good.
So I'm guessing this is one of those points where Colin's audio dropped out and I don't actually know what he said, right?
Yeah, that's probably a really important noun right there.
I said, what did you guys think of Sterling's?
Didn't hear it that time either.
So I thought Sterling's was pretty cool.
I was just being an asshole.
I like the distinction that Travis is making between the two of them. I don't, which is to say the werewolf bar and the Fang Bar. I don't know that I fully understand the line he's trying to draw between Marcus's ownership of the bar and the new ownership, but Isabella's ownership. But I think the line he's drawing between the two is interesting, where he's sort of setting up the werewolves as the more working class folk of the town, which is interesting because they would be then still the working class humans who are actually doing the work in the mines. And the vampires as maybe a more elevated class in the town. And I don't know if that will prove out if we see more of the world around them, but I think it's an interesting line to begin drawing as he creates this sort of triangle of relationships and the politics of Dry River.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. The way he describes it as being very, you know, chrome and polished type of place, at least as I envision it, I think was very, you know, it was well described and really drawn a distinction between, you know, the fur bar versus the Fang Bar. And I actually really like the sequence with the ghost shark, card shark, the ghost card shark.
Glass shark.
Oh, that would have been a good tie-in. I guess they're not really the self-referential folk as much as outside media, but would have been a good tie. Yeah, I did. Before we talk about characters in the bar, I had a thought when he was describing it, though, and that if everything is chrome and polished and sort of shiny, but they're vampires, they don't have reflections.
And this came up later, too, when they were talking about the vampires all being asleep at night. We do need... It is time for vampire rules with a Z.
Like, yeah, we definitely need to know. Because they're not scared of sunlight anymore.
Yeah, like it's getting to a place where understanding some of these things is going to like fill in clues about how all of this is happening.
Right, and who could have been where when, like, physically possible.
Yeah. Ah, real vampires.
Yes, a very, very good joke. That Justin, God, he really is just killing it this arc. I just can't It's just so good. All of his jokes are so good. We come to Gandhi wanting to play poker with the card shark M, and I am somewhat perplexed by Clint's choice to play her as, like, I guess he's playing her as a card shark, like playing dumb to get information out of M, though I can't quite tell if that was Clint's intention or not.
I thought so. You know, and I thought that, like, one-liner at the end where Gandhi's like, oh yeah, when I won this poker tournament a year ago, like, completely got glossed over. You know?
Right. But do you think, was that meant to be a joke about her being bad at poker or being... I guess I just didn't fully understand what Clint was trying to say about Gandhi.
You know, and so I think putting all of those pieces together shows us that Gandhi is much more deliberate, and she might have this sort of young and innocent air, but all of it in that case might be set dressing so that she can do what she needs to.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, and so, like, that even makes me go back to, you know, her interactions with Uncle Oni, right? Like, how much is she trying to play him too?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I give her that much credit, especially considering how she used those five questions she won and got.
I think that this is, like, a very tricky line to follow, but I think that is a failing of Clint, not Gandhi, which is a weird logical separation to make, but the Gandhi character that Clint is aspiring to would not have made that mistake, but Clint, in getting excited and sort of rolling through stuff, did.
I'm gonna have a tough time making that distinction, because I don't know that you can separate the two of them, you know?
I mean, it gets into a weird thing of, like, are we then saying that Clint is role-playing the character he created wrong? Which,
right,
is a road I do not want to go down.
Right, right. Exactly. So, I mean, I just thought it was a very, very much like a, almost like a Merle thing to do. Or just, okay, you have five questions to learn as much as you can about this case, and then they're tangentially related at best. You know, they don't provide any real help.
And from an NPC that we have not been given any reason to think has any critical information for them.
Right.
Yeah, just because she's a ghost doesn't mean
all-knowing.
Squat.
Yeah.
Right, but you don't know that she doesn't know anything either.
Yeah, and we weren't able to find that out.
It's tricky. It's a tricky wire to walk.
It's tricky.
I just love Griffin's reaction.
I had an I bet I know how this question gets answered, but when Gandhi's getting poker chips and Griffin decides that Gandhi is, like, rich and has no concept of wealth, thoughts, it seems strange. I guess it makes sense for the character, but it just seems a strange little thing to be put upon Clint to play through.
Oh, yeah. And so I Clint never really seemed to address it that much.
Yeah.
And so, like, I still ascribe that to, they don't know Gandhi that well. And so, sure, that might be Errol's perception of Gandhi, but again, that whole situation was Gandhi playing a character.
So you think for that card match, everything was calculated for what Clint wanted Gandhi to do?
Yes.
Yeah, but the issue with that is, so I think that makes sense, you know, kind of play it as a naive person, and really make yourself look like a mark so you can then kind of, you know, come back around and win. You can sandbag it a little bit and then you know, win convincingly, which she does. And all of that would make sense if she hadn't essentially wasted the five questions.
Yeah, those are tricky to align. I think you're right.
And no, and that's where I agree with Chris. Like, it felt like Clint got really excited and just started talking. And
well, I mean, Clint then did, but that means so did Gandy. Which means I don't know how much of you know, how much of this brilliant plan we can ascribe to her as making herself a mark and then winning.
Well, I mean, there's a pretty solid history of Clint having higher aspirations and then kind of failing to play them properly. So I think that is something you could chalk up to it being funny that Clint is bad at role-playing games. But I don't know that it was an intentional choice, unlike some other times when that has come through. Mm-hmm. I can't square allowing Gandy to have been sharking, like, purposely playing this up for M, and then blowing the questions. Like, I think that's those two things are hard to exist together on one theory. But I also don't like the idea that Clint was just following Griffin's lead on, yes, it's funny if she has no concept of money, and then that. Because is that the impetus for all this to happen then? What would have happened if Griffin had said, would he just gone and got $5? Or, you know, what was the plan, I wonder?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree that it's hard to marry the two ideas, except that, you know, we know that they kind of wasted the five questions. And we know that they may have been card sharking. I mean, that one is not assured, especially considering, you know, at least in fiction, Augustus was helping her cheat.
Right. Right.
That's not really ascribed to her abilities. It's more ascribed to, you know, Augustus's thinking of finding a way to help her cheat.
And
make sure she
but we
won.
Don't know if she needed it.
Well, so that's the tricky part too though. Like, just given the game system, if Gandy's plan is to be bad and then good, how do you do that in a role-based system where you're trusting to the dice anyway? Because there's not like there's a mechanic that I know of. I mean, maybe there is one in the game that Travis would let Clint pull off where if he rolled really well on the first one, but then wanted to have Travis tell the NPC that, I don't know. It's just a weird.
Yeah, I don't
when
know
you're
that
trusting
you can pull
it off. Dice, you can't control for, I'm going to be bad and then be good to get this money out of this person or get information out of this person, which is what would have needed to happen for Gandy to pull off a proper plan. You know, which would have gone in, lost some money, said, let's go again, and then put the stakes on the table to get some answers, and then actually done well, as opposed to just doing well twice.
Right, which leads me to believe that maybe she wasn't card sharking at all.
Yeah. So that scene was confusing, I guess, is where we've arrived at, and didn't give us a whole lot of information.
And also how M doesn't even bat an eye that suddenly Augustus appears and is friends with Gandy, and
yeah,
you know, there's no questioning there. Yeah, exactly, right? Well, that was sketchy, because I would have loved to see a bar fight.
With
a ghost bar fight?
That would have been awesome.
Where they're both just throwing pints of root beer at each other, but
they can't be touched.
Neither of them can be hit by it, and then they just yell at each other, but they can't.
Well, ghosts can touch each other, remember?
Can they?
Oh, right. We did create that. But like, if they were throwing corporeal objects at each other, they couldn't. Those things wouldn't touch
them. Well, yeah, no. They would dive into each other and fight.
Punch and hit and things.
All right. I agree. We need a ghost bar fight.
Yeah.
Coming this next month on Sci-Fi, Ghost Bar Fight.
Oof, that'd be a good one. So, one thing I didn't want to go back to that I thought was very, very funny, because we talked about this during Amnesty, was how the GM was treating sort of mixed success versus full success on the rolls. And I think Travis did a really great job with that when Griffin rolled to try to catch the root beer bottle in a way that Griffin never really put the like consequences and successes were all sort of just fit what he did. And I think what he wanted to happen, and I don't know if Travis went that way, but I think it was brilliant to have Errol catch the glass and have all the root beer fall out. Because if that stays a running gag where Errol can't get a root beer, I am all in. I think that's a very funny bit, and is just...
Even his quest for beverages in general, because, you know, when he's over at the Mathis home...
Oh, trying to get a coffee.
Hey, yo, can I get that coffee?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it will be his taco quest.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a very good bit, and I totally agree on the idea of a better... That said, this mixed success was better implemented, but it was also of very little consequence. So we'll have to see what happens when that happens at a more meaningful time. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Like, there still haven't been, you know, in this system at all. Like, there still haven't been any really bad roles. So I'm interested to see what's going to happen. You know, what do these costs actually look like?
Yeah, and I mean, based on the way it's playing out so far, I think it might come to a head in the next episode when they really have to negotiate with people some more and try to leverage against what people know and persuasion to see what's going on. So far, we haven't had a lot of need for them to really do anything involving the game system itself, except for faction roles and a little bit of persuasion earlier. Which I think is interesting, and that sort of leads us to a conversation of this system, and in general, is if they're going for a storytelling thing, this certainly seems to fit that well, where they can just kind of hang out and tell the story and work through things and not really have to rely too heavily on a rule set. But I wonder if that means that there's not enough there to make it a game still, that if we're just gonna leave a couple moments up to chance, is there a point to it, or can it just be that one of them tells the story, the other one participated, and they just decide that didn't work because it's funnier or, you know, what have you?
Right.
Well, and I think that gets back to, you know, combat being the other sort of tenet of role-playing games, right? You know, it's exploration and discussion and combat, sort of.
Yeah.
And in both Amnesty and, you know, in Dust, you know, there was very little combat in Amnesty and none so far in Dust, and I don't get the impression that there's going to be a lot. Like, it doesn't feel like it's going to be a combat-heavy story.
Yeah, right. They've never discussed the rules for combat in this.
Yeah, system. And so I almost wonder if there needs to be a fusion of the two kind of rules. You know, I think you're right that this makes sense for storytelling, and I think it helps interactions a lot. But maybe it means in season two bringing in a D&D style combat system to augment that would be a better solution to sort of help us.
Some more robust rule set for combat, whereas they can sort of fly by the quick two dice rolls for personal interactions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think ascribing combat as a necessary part of role-playing games, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think it would depend on, you know, which game you're playing. And so if you're playing one that's, you know, as this one seems to be heavy on, not necessarily puzzles, but trying to figure out a mystery, trying to solve a mystery, maybe you don't need the combat.
Yeah, I think you are right on that. But I guess it's hard, and that is just a requirement as a listener, that I find it hard to separate that from sort of the balance arc, where combat was such a big part of what they were doing and going through and really doing the dungeon crawl part of Dungeons & Dragons kind of deal. Not in proper dungeons, but in levels that were laid out that way. Whereas...
You know, and I think it gave us a lot of you know, it gave us a lot of opportunities to see characters interact in different ways. And, you know, how much of our character development do we get from Magnus rushes in and Taco's good out here? Like, their reactions to sort of combat situations actually do tell us a lot about the character, and it provides opportunities for growth as well. But you're right. I don't think it's necessary, Colin.
I don't disagree at all, but I mean, I don't expect to see any real character growth in a 5-ep arc anyway. So it will depend on what we see in season 2. I think you're right. I do hope we go back to a combat system, because I think it's very entertaining.
And my concern would be is without combat, I wonder how they'll do a sense of peril, or really sort of driving home the mission that they're on and sort of the danger that they might be in. With this one, Travis has created the time limit, which I think is great for engendering a sense of tension and really motivation for the characters, but we don't know if we're going to come to care about the characters in, you know, for this arc, for any arc, you sort of want them to succeed. And if they're not in any danger physically, then I don't know what we need to sort of do about that. We need to be worried about them? If they fail to solve this murder, like, that sucks for Dry River, but it sort of seems like these people could just move on to a different town and that's okay. Does that hurt our ability to really become engaged with them as fans and really root for them to succeed and worried that they might fail? You know, and if combat, you know, because if they can't, we already talked about one's a ghost already, so he can't die, so hit points don't matter. The other one's a half werewolf, and then Gandhi is apparently a brilliant card shark. So the ways in which they could get out of sticky situations using luck and logic and their way with words and their means seem to be numerous, but if they were in physical peril, it adds a very different level of tension and might create different bonding experiences between A, the characters with each other, I think, to your point, Jake, but also to how we interact with those characters, how we feel about them. Like, oh my god, Magnus almost died. Or, you know, Clint doesn't have an arm anymore. Merle doesn't have an arm anymore.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And I wonder in this system if the corruption aspect is supposed to play into that somewhat.
I think that would definitely seem to be the case, because that is where we will lose a character.
Right.
Seems like a good time to talk about. We're going to go out of order a little bit. We talk about what happens in Isabella Slate's house. See some of Augustus's true colors come out, perhaps.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I did as well.
You know, it was sort of Chekhov's werewolf, right? Vampire. Because Travis wouldn't have name dropped Marcus leaving under suspicious circumstances in that first episode if he wasn't going to come back. But this is certainly not the way that I expected him to come back.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so, like, I really wonder, you know, what Isabella's role in all of this is. Is she the Banshee?
It certainly makes her out to be a much bigger character than maybe initially laid out to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, although it does seem strange that... It does seem strange that they want some information on a murder and what's happened. And so let me take you to this guy that's been locked in my basement for 2 years.
Yeah, right. Like,
yeah,
he's really got his ear to the ground.
Unless these are things that have been in motion for much longer than, you know, even the Fangs and the Furs have been planning to.
But I think
join
the,
forces.
The trick of it, though, is it Isabella defaulting to bring them to Marcus indicates that Isabella knows more about what's going on than she is letting on to them. And it seems like if she knows enough about what's happening to think that Marcus would be valuable, I think she would know enough for them to just talk to Isabella about it. That maybe Marcus didn't need to be involved.
You know, I think that's hand waving. You know, oh, hey, I'm being helpful and directing you to this person so you don't ask me questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, and his help was not that helpful.
It was not.
I think maybe it was not for us. I wonder if the characters needed to hear it.
I mean,
that's fair.
I mean, I don't... you could tell even by Gandhi's reaction, she was like, look, if I'm actually going to do this, I'm going to need, you know, some actual information, because you just told me if there's nobody in the town that it makes sense to have done this, look somewhere else. Well, okay.
Here's Thanks. The only somewhere else I know.
Yeah, yeah. And so she follows it up with the more direct question, who is the Banshee?
Right. So
which is probably another discussion unto itself.
Yeah, and I'm willing to get into it now, because we're coming up on time. I don't know, time is arbitrary. We sort of made up the number, but whatever. So the Banshee comes up twice in pretty rapid succession without any seeming prompting or anything outside of the setup episode mentioning that it exists. And that is very confusing to me. Why did the audio all arrive there? Well, I guess... I guess my question is, why did Clint choose the Banshee as opposed to, you know, I need to meet with someone in the church or something like that? Like, why did the Banshee stick out for him? And then, was Travis always planning to have Errol picked up by the Banshee, or did that one come out of the other?
Well, I think it's more a case of some offline talk.
Yeah,
because I don't think they get there without some sort of discussion happening between the brothers and Clint to figure out, you know, when is she going to come into play? When are we going to, you know, mention her again? I don't know if the specifics were shared, but something must have been dropped offline.
In setup, we learn that Travis has created the character of the Banshee as sort of this crime lord out in the world. But it's Errol who decides to have been previously associated with the Banshee. And I don't remember if Gandhi has a previous association with the Banshee.
I don't think so.
But not that I recall.
Isn't there some confusing link that he created? Like, there's a... Errol is protecting a... Because Errol owes Gandhi a debt, is that right? Or Gandhi owes Errol a debt? There's a map on the Reddit that I need to go find.
I know...
Because there's a witch that they're hiding or something.
Errol
Yeah,
is,
the person who tried to, like...
To stop Errol's, like...
Yeah, to, like, unwerewolf him or something.
Yeah, unwerewolf.
Lives in Dry River, and Errol is protecting them.
Yeah.
But
which I never
somehow,
quite...
Clint somehow bought Gandhi into it. Didn't he?
That connection, I don't remember.
Maybe I'm making that up.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
I'll go back and listen to setup again.
But I did think it was strange that Errol would be protecting this woman who didn't really help him anyway.
Yeah, except as them both being on the run from the Banshee, perhaps. Though I don't know that we got a very clear picture of what Errol's relationship to the Banshee was when he sort of left their employ. We got sort of sidetracked on that Banshee conversation, but I think that was interesting. I want to talk more about Justin's Augustus choices. Because I know he said he was going to embrace... I think Justin is doing just such a great job, and I really enjoy that he's playing simultaneously the comedic relief and the more evil of all the three characters. And evil sort of in quotes, because it's sort of... He's trying to serve a purpose. He's pitching it as sort of scientific research for Gandhi, and I think maybe he's just the one who's willing to make the hard choices, being a corporate magnate of some ill repute, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think it's a great... I think he's playing to his character pretty well. And I think Gandhi and Clint's willingness to go along with it really shows an embrace of the system, which I think is very cool.
Mm-hmm. And again, like I appreciated that moment as a reflection of Gandhi's competence, like weighing the costs and benefits and being like, okay, you know, here is the time to show my cards and be, you know,
I do
in charge like I could be.
Yeah, I did somewhat wonder how it jives, and they kind of point this out because they talk about, you know, you're afraid of death, so this turn you immortal. And again, we get back to we don't understand vampire rules. But it does seem like, given Gandhi's very clear fear and hatred of death, that anything that would cause her harm, I would have thought might have given her more pause. But I wonder if because this is in the context of sort of furthering the investigation and learning what they need to do, if that's a different side of Gandhi, sort of like another tier of Gandhi that we haven't seen, versus she's totally okay with dead bodies, science, great. Really, really hates death as a, you know, person, Michael. But then taking on harm or putting herself in harmful situations, I wonder, is maybe, Jake, to your point, her just showing competence and dedication and a willingness to really figure things out and being confident that she can then get out of it on the back end? Or maybe there's something we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
What she knows or doesn't know about how to cheat death.
That's true, yeah. I was a bit confused about that whole situation, though. Like, and maybe I was wrong, and this will clear it up, but I thought Isabella was human.
It doesn't seem that way.
Right, yeah, I guess not.
You know, and so, like, you know, the first time they were talking about taking place in the feeding, I thought Isabella was feeding Marcus to keep him alive because she was human. But if she's not, or if she is and has some other designs, you know, I guess I'm just a little confused about that whole setup. Like, we sort of launched into it really quickly, and I'm glad that you guys weren't just clearly like, oh yeah, they clearly said that she was human or a vampire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's a vampire. I feel pretty confident saying that right now, because she's going to drink Gandhi's blood.
Yes, but it wasn't said in the story, right?
Yeah, I don't know that was said in the story, and I think you might be right that they... I'll have to go back and listen to setup again, because I could have sworn you were right that they said she was a human who had taken over the bar from Marcus, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't recall.
You know, and so, like, if she's a vampire, fine, it makes sense. But I also, you know, wouldn't think that a vampire would choose to feed... Again, vampire rules, like... Vampires don't typically feed on other vampires, but...
Is Marcus a vampire?
Yeah, do we know that?
I thought he was.
I don't know that we know that.
Okay, well, then...
Maybe we're supposed to know that. Maybe we're bad listeners again. Come on, Colin, you're supposed to be the good listener.
I don't think they ever... said Marcus was a vampire. That I can recall. All right,
well, listeners, we know you know. You let us know.
Hashtag thank you. Hashtag bad listening.
We should talk about the interaction that Errol has at the Mathis house.
So before we do that... I thought it was very funny to see the interaction between Travis and Griffin, where it clearly seems that Travis does not see Griffin as like part of Dry River.
Yeah.
And Griffin definitely does.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 8 months, one person cannot turn a whole neighborhood around.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, you know, it's
like that whole idea that, oh man, Errol's great for the community and has helped turned it around and is like a community garden that people are familiar with and thankful for, and, you know, Yeah. One dude can't do that in 8 months, especially if there's lots of insularity already happening.
Well, yeah. And I liked Travis's workaround where he's like, okay, well, there's sort of a community like this in every city in the territory, and so this one's just familiar to you. It was, oh, yeah, because I live in the one down the block, in the house down the block. Well, and then I think Travis just sort of lets it go. It's like, okay, yeah, sure. You live in, but there's clearly still some sort of disconnect between.
Well, I honestly think it makes it a little more awkward to be have the Mathis house be in Errol's neighborhood because, sort of to the earlier point we were talking about, like, they're going through a lot of exposition and introduction and small talky things that would not be necessary if you lived down the street from each other, especially in the way that Errol is describing his role in the community. Like,
right.
There should be no question to Liam of who Errol is if Errol,
yeah.
if Errol is being, exists in the way that Griffin wants him to.
And it's, I also think that, you know, Griffin having additional power in, on Carrion Street, that makes sense if he's the big dog.
Yeah, nice job. Good one.
But the Mathis family is clearly the big dog. So why would he want to be on Carrion Street, right? Like, why would he have wanted those things to coincide?
Yeah, I would also have to guess that given the way they've described things, the Mathis neighborhood probably doesn't need a whole lot of fixing up if the Mathises live there. Being the money of the, you know, half the money of the town, it's probably a nice part of the neighborhood. And it sounds like what Griffin has described Errol doing is picking up a more downtrodden piece of the community. I mean, I don't know if those are necessarily going to shake out. We don't have any concept of, like, true wealth of the town or anything like that. But it seems like those things don't necessarily jive with what he wants Errol's mission to be.
Agreed.
Yeah.
There's... And again, that time frame is just buck wild to me. Like, do you have, like...
Well, and because it also... What also threw me for a loop is Travis lays out that the Mathis matriarch picked Errol's team because of the work they were doing, or whatever. Which also elsewhere. Just seems like... Like, what are we talking about here? Are they a they exist as a team already, and they just go around the Crescent Territory? Like, neither of them... Gandhi, I thought, was pretty new to the area... to Dry River itself, but maybe they've been in the territory before, and if they've been in the territory before, does Errol just travel for work? And then he can't be home? I mean, I don't... I just don't... There is a lot of pretense here that I do not understand.
Agreed. Yeah.
I don't think it was fleshed out to begin with, and I think the fact that Griffin and Travis haven't sat down and, like, figured it out...
Yeah.
Maybe it's not that important, but I think there's definitely some disconnect.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, it's not...
make sense.
And it's strange to think about how it's affecting the listening experience. Sort of the same, it's the same thing with not knowing vampire rules. Like, if these things lined up, I could focus more on the storyline, whereas trying to just square these pieces of facts that we get, it's like, well, what does that mean for their interactions and all these things, I think is detracting from the story. Which I think just plays into our constant talk of the mini arcs are very tricky to work on with fully fleshed out to have fully fleshed out characters and also tell a story in 5 episodes.
Right.
Obviously we're clearly seeing that something has to give or it becomes a little bit messy.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the right answer to that is. I hope the McElroys find it. I believe they'll get there. They're, you know, clearly getting better as they do every one of them, but, I think it's tricky to try to look at these things and really pull the story they want us to get without being able to put all the facts to it and be able to even have the characters understand what they're able to do in the world.
Yeah, I agree.
So, do you guys think Liam did it?
No.
Yeah. Also, no.
Seems unlikely.
You know, it's. If this is the crime procedural, it's never the first person that you suspect. Like,
yeah, it's not lupus.
It's never that convenient it's never option.
Yeah, that would have been a little too easy.
especially since like lupus, lupine, werewolf, it all goes together.
Nice. Nice.
And I I like that, you know, they had that a very, you know, evocative description of the badge they carry.
Yeah.
It's going to get a lot of fan art. Just tons and tons of fan art of a circle that says Grayson's.
Right. So good. And Griffin's immediate dismissal of, we're working on it.
Yeah. I think we learned a lot of interesting information, though. I'd kind of had the inkling of sort of a Romeo and Juliet situation, just because there are two houses and they're different, and that's where that story always goes.
Right.
So I think it's interesting to hear that. And interesting to put a flesh in the middle of it. You know, Anne is neither Montague nor Capulet, really, because she's different. You know? So I think that'll be like an interesting... It gets to sort of the broader politics. Does her name carry as much weight if she isn't a fur? Is that marriage more palatable to both parties because she isn't, you know, either one? Or is it worse? And I think that's interesting and, you know, definitely casts this whole mystery in a different light.
Yeah, I definitely think it's an interesting decision to have. I mean, I think you're right. I think it immediately speaks to a Romeo and Juliet type story. But you're absolutely right. And the fact that she doesn't quite fit in either one adds a little bit of a different wrinkle. That we can't tell, you know, what effect that could have on various motivations.
Yeah.
So Errol wraps up at the Mathis house, having gotten some amount of information from Anne, but it didn't seem like there was a lot to be gained there. Honestly, the biggest piece of information we got was really from Marcus, and it didn't seem to be all that groundbreaking, but that was what seemed to be the big nugget they got out of this episode. And which is built upon by the fact of when Errol leaves the Mathis house, he gets picked up by a pair of, I suppose, goons, though Travis doesn't quite call them goons, from the Banshee.
Cronies,
yes.
Croons
is tricky. I don't know that it needs to be a...
Goonies.
Oh, God.
Goonies.
Great. Nailed it. We've made the Goonies now. Which I guess implies that the Banshee is in the Crescent territory. Did we know that?
I thought we did. Like I kind of assume everybody exists within the... Everybody that's been mentioned
exists. I think there's no differentiating at this point. Like, it's all happening right around here.
Yeah, it seems like maybe the things we know don't exist outside of the Crescent territory. That's all very self-contained in this little area that Travis created.
Yeah. You know, and so I think it's interesting that there are pieces moving that we haven't quite nailed down yet and that our players don't quite know how to respond to yet.
Yeah.
I appreciated Griffin's response to like, you know, we'd like you to come with us. And well, when people say that, it doesn't actually turn out too well for the other person, does it?
Right. I've seen this before.
I don't know what that's going to mean. That's what I'm most excited to see next episode. Especially given Errol's existing connection to the Banshee, you know.
Yeah.
What kind of conversation is that going to be? Is it going to be a, you know, hey, I will let you off the hook if you stop messing around in this.
Well, Jake, it sounds like it's time to go to the zone of postulation.
Zone of postulation.
And you can tell us what you think is going to happen, not just what might happen.
Okay. Well, I think that the Banshee is going to propose a debt, you know, an owed debt. That will sort of compromise Errol's role in this investigation, and his role that he's trying to build in the community. And I still don't think Marcus is down and out. I think he has a bigger role to play. And I wonder if maybe Marcus is the Banshee.
Mm.
And all of the Isabella stuff is set dressing. Because, you know, Errol didn't go see him. You know,
that was a
Gandhi and Augustus interaction.
Right.
So that's sort of what I'm postulating for this week.
I'll say, I think the opposite is true. I think Isabella is the Banshee. And maybe sort of playing at working through a couple things to get herself into town and then tear things apart. I think what's going to come out is that Gandhi maybe doesn't come out great after the feeding, and then Errol discovers Augustus and Gandhi with the Banshee when he's brought in, and there becomes a bit of some tension between Augustus and Errol that needs to be resolved over sort of Gandhi's fate in this investigation, which then shakes out into some fun little internal conflict before they try to tackle the larger issue of why Isabel is trying to destroy the town for some reason.
Okay.
See how it shakes out.
I also think the Banshee will be somebody we've heard of, although I don't think it'll be somebody we've met. And I forget the person's name, but the person who's in the church, I think that will ultimately be the Banshee, the one place they haven't gone yet, despite being prodded that way a couple times.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep. I think that's where, and I don't know, I haven't figured out yet what the, you know, the reason why, the motivation behind, trying to break apart the deal, but I think that's where the Banshee will be. I think Errol will go there but not know where he is. And I think Gandhi and Augustus will just try and figure out as much as they can for Marcus after Gandhi loses all of her blood and dies.
And now there's two ghosts.
Yeah, we're just, and I think the Banshee will kill Errol, and it will just be a ghost team.
Ghost team, squad. Best team.
That's right.
Coming this fall on Sci-Fi, Ghost Team.
Oof. Hey, Sci-Fi, get at us. We've got ideas for days.
Ghost NATO.
You can't touch it until it wants you to.
That's oddly sexual.
Yeah. Not gonna get into that one.
This might be going on a different network.
Yeah, Morpheus can
sci-fi after dark.
So
even
anyway,
later.
Those are our predictions. Thanks for listening to We Do That. Next week, we will cover the next episode of Dust.
In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at WeDoThat_pod or email us at WeDoThatPod@gmail.com. Send us your reactions, thoughts, and theories.
So we can shamelessly steal them.
Special thanks to The Early for our intro and outro music.
New episodes of We Do That come out every Monday after The Adventure Zone.
And hey, if you like listening to us, please, go onto iTunes, leave us a review, rate us, subscribe, and share with all of your friends that listen to The Adventure Zone.
Or don't listen to The Adventure Zone, and they'll be confused, but they're going to like it.
Yeah, great background noise.
Yeah, you can put us on anywhere. So until next week, bye everybody.